I'm sure it's only going to get better. So with that, we welcome 30 participants, including Philip Kern from Sydney, Australia, to continue his discussion and presentation on Jacob. And two aspects or two lectures on Jacob. Thank you for starting us off last week, Phil. And there's some other announcements. We'll begin.
Phil had another document that I sent out probably, 10, 15 minutes ago.
Oh, really?
So if you didn't remember seeing it, take a look at your email and you can download the document.
I don't see it, Neil.
Hold it up again, Barry.
So it did go, and that would be today, and I don't see it. Boy, you stop coming to the chapel for a couple of months, and that's what happens. All right. Neil, would you like to commend us to the Lord for the study?
Sure. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this nice day and the nice weather. We thank you for your blessings on us, and we thank you that you are unchanging and we can rely on you through difficult times, and we're thankful for safety and protection. We just pray that we can act according to your will and look to you for strength. Thank you for Phil joining us and speaking about Jacob and the many lessons that we can learn, many good lessons and things also that we should avoid. And just ask that you would help Phil as he brings the message, and thank you for his efforts and his work. We thank you for everyone here, and we just pray for health and prosperity to those that are joining here. And thank you for the Lord Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen.
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 Okay, I thought we'd jump in today at chapter 32, and I'll look at a fair bit of chapter 32 and then into chapter 33. In some ways, the story of Jacob is, there and back again, or the prodigal return, something like that. And you see, especially in the Old Testament prophets, they pick up on that idea. You need to be, the nation of Israel is told, you need to be like Jacob. Jacob left, but he returned. You need to come back to me. And so chapter 32 is the point where Jacob is now coming back. In chapter 31, Jacob was sort of on the run. He's fleeing from Laban. That is to say, way back 20 years earlier, Jacob had run away from his brother, and now he's running back into the land. He's run away from the land, now he's running back to the land. And when we get to chapter 32, he's now on the edge of the land, and has the situation changed in the land so that he can live and thrive there in safety? There's no way to for Jacob to know. And with no lines of communication, he doesn't know what he's going to find there. So when he arrives in the land in chapter 32, he meets with, a band of angels. And that's kind of unexpected. He sees that there's the camp of God, so he calls the place Mahanaim. And then he sends messengers. And so now we're getting into the engagement with Esau. He sends messengers ahead of him to Esau in the country of Edom. And Esau and Edom are really the same word. And he instructed them, this is what you are to say to my master Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I've been staying with Laban and have remained there until now. In other words, look, I've been gone for 20 years, but it was no big deal. I was just visiting the relatives. Okay. Now I'm back from my extended travels. And while I was there, I acquired some property, and I've got cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, men servants and maid servants. Now I am sending this message to my Lord that I might find favor in your eyes. In other words, it's no big deal that I was gone long, but while I was gone, I prospered. You know, I did really well. And so I've got these things I can give you. In other words, I'm not coming to take things away from you. All their life, Jacob's been taking things away from Esau, and he's saying, you don't really need to fear me. I have so much that you don't need to worry about that anymore. I've got all this prosperity that I'm bringing along. And so he is on the way back, and things are unfolding in this way, except that they're not. In verse 6, the messengers return, and they say, we went to your brother Esau, and he's coming to meet you. That's ambiguous. And there are 400 men with him, and that's probably a little bit less ambiguous. Think back to the story when David is going to kill Nabal. Abigail's wise intercession puts a stop to that. But the army that David was bringing was 400 men. So that's a pretty substantial number in those days. And here comes Jacob with 400, Esau with 400 men accompanying him. And so Esau is intimidating, and Jacob is afraid. And verse 7 amplifies that for us. There's fear, there's distress on Jacob's part. And what does he do? He divides the people who were with him into two groups, and flocks and herds and camels as well. So we're reminded that this is a big group. It's a substantial number of people and all the property that goes with it. And Jacob is thinking, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape. So he's expecting a battle, and he's hoping that some people can survive the fight. And he's probably hoping that he's one of the people who survives the fight. Well, Jacob has a couple plans, alternatives even. And the first one is he prays. Okay, there's this God out there who's helped me along the way. He's made promises to me. And God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac. He doesn't say my God, but one that's associated with his parents and grandparents. Oh Lord, who said to me, go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper. And then down in verse 12, we read, but you have said, I will surely make you prosper. There's that notion again. And will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted. So God, you've made these great promises, but you know, you're also the one who told me to go back. So if you have a positive view of Jacob, you would hear him saying, look, you're a promise-making God, and the only way you can fulfill these promises is to bring me safely through this, and that's the sort of God you are. But another way to hear this is, if you're a little bit less well-disposed toward Jacob, is this. Look, God, you got me into this mess. You told me to go back. You're the one who said I have to return, and here I am, and there's an army standing in front of me that is threatening to destroy me. So what are you going to do about this situation that you got me into? Eve in the garden, Adam in the garden, you know, it's sort of human history to blame somebody else and ultimately to blame God. And I wonder if we need to think of whether that's a reality in our own lives at times. Do we sometimes blame God for what is in effect his goodness toward us? Verse 10 is extraordinary. It's, I think, the first hint of spiritual insight on the part of Jacob. He says, I'm unworthy. And if he'd stopped right there, we would all agree. He's unworthy of anything in the same way that we are unworthy of any of God's goodness. But he goes on to say, of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. So this is a really important formula at work here. It's the same language, the love and or loving kindness and faithfulness that we find in a number of the Psalms when God reveals himself to Moses in Exodus, when Moses says, show me your face. The first thing God does is reveal himself as the God of loving kindness and faithfulness. So this is the language that's used in those really important places. Something that I think is significant here is you never find it in the plural, except in this one instance within the Pentateuch, so that all the love and kindness, all the faithfulness you've shown to me, it's really an extravagant statement of God's goodness to Jacob. And he's saying, I didn't deserve that. And I think it's the first time where he's really come to terms with his frailty, his weakness in his humanity, and you might even say his sinful nature. This same language, I think, gets picked up in John 1, verses 14 and 18, when Jesus is said to be the fullness of God, the revelation of grace and truth. That's how John presents Moses alongside Jesus. Jesus is full of grace and truth. So he's drawing on that language from Moses, but I think we're seeing that same sort of extravagant language as we get right here. So Jacob is finally starting to figure some things out. He says, I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan. That's the first time when he was on his trip the other direction. Now I've become so abundantly wealthy that I'm two groups. Verse 11, save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I'm afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. So Jacob's life is in danger, and so is the whole clan, at least his side of it. And it's the hand of Esau. And I won't belabor the point, but there were a lot of references to the hand or the hands of Esau early on in the story. So we know that even when he was born, he was a hairy child. And the hairy hands of Esau play a significant role in the theft of the birthright, because Jacob puts those hides on, deer skins, as it were, so that Esau could touch him and feel the hairy hands. So the hands of Esau are significant, and now that's the thing that he's afraid of, the hand of Esau. The hand of Esau was the means of deception. Now the hand of Esau is the cause of fear, and he's up front. He says, I'm afraid that he's going to come and destroy me, but you have said you're going to do all these things for me. So you've written a check, God, and I want you to cash it now for me. And so he spends the night there, and while he's there, verse 13, from all those goods he has with him, he selects a gift for his brother Esau, and it consists of, now, I don't know if you have any experience with farming. I don't really, so it's hard for me to understand exactly what this would be worth in today's situation, but I think quite a bit. And so think back to what it would have been worth when, you know, you're a wandering shepherd, herdsman, that sort of thing. It would be an absurd gift. If Esau wasn't a wealthy man, this in one go would have made him a wealthy man. It would have set him up for subsequent generations. It's so lavish. And this is what Jacob is planning to give to him. 200 female goats and 20 male goats. There's a herd right there. 200 ewes and 20 rams. Jesus talks about somebody who's got 100. Nathan, when he rebukes David, talks about somebody who's got one sheep. Here, we're talking about hundreds. And in addition, we've got 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their young, 40 cows and 10 bulls. Any one of these would be enough to start a herd. And Jacob is giving this lavish wealth out of fear, motivated by fear. And he put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to the servants, go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds. So now you've got a succession of herds that are going toward Esau. There might be a number of reasons for this. We're going to read about one in a moment. But if somebody's coming at you with an army of 400 people, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of animals that you can bring at that army, if nothing else, it's going to slow the army down, isn't it? So you send those animals forward, and now in the road or in the way, in the path, the attacking army will have to deal with all this noise and interference that these animals would generate. So you're to go ahead and keep some space. And where's Jacob going to be? Well, he's going to be in the back, clearly enough. And then verse 17, he instructed the one in the lead, when my brother Esau meets you and asks, to whom do you belong and where are you going and who owns all these animals in front of you, these huge herds, then you are to say, they belong to, and hear these words, they belong to your servant. They belong to your servant Jacob. They're a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us. Now here, verse 18 is very explicit. Where is Jacob going to be? He's going to be the last one in the parade. Okay, he's going to take up the tail end. And again, when we get a bit of a summary in verse 20, Jacob is coming behind us. So twice we're told that Jacob is going to be at the end of this procession of animals and people who will come to meet Esau. So I want to drill in just for a moment at verse 18 and note the language of your servant. So I've got this in the notes if you have access to it. Let's go right back sort of at the top of the notes, just about where I quote from Genesis 25, verse 23. And this verse is the Lord speaking to Rebecca. And the Lord has said, two nations are in your womb, and two people from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. So clearly, in God's plan, the servant will be the older one. The younger is the one who is served. The notion of lordship and bowing down and all these things, well, the direction in which they move is pretty clear from what the Lord said. Now, in chapter 27, 29, and again, you can see that, Isaac flips this on his head. Isaac is blessing, well, he thinks it's Esau. He thinks it's the older one. And here's what he says, may nations serve you and peoples bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers. By the way, he's only got one. Be lord over your brothers and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. So Isaac is clearly taking the same language as God had used to elevate the younger one, and he's reversing the order back to what it should be, at least according to his preferences, and clearly in keeping with cultural practices. The older one is being set up as the one who, well, receives the blessing and gets all the goods, you might say, and is served by the younger one. So God has turned convention on its head. Isaac is trying to get it right way up again. And I think what's happening here is this blessing that Isaac gave him, which Jacob had stolen, which had cost him so much, which had driven him from the land and destroyed the family, is completely and utterly worthless. Let me jump back to chapter 27, verse 37. When Isaac is approached by Esau, and Esau says, isn't there any blessing left? Isaac says, I have made him lord over you and made all his relatives his servants. And I stand back from that and ask, really? Isaac is the one who has the capacity to do that? He presented himself as an old man who was about to die, and now he's saying, I have made him lord. I have done these things. How can that mean anything? He was going against the word of God, and he's saying, I did these things. So those are two strikes against him, in my opinion. How can that have any value? And Jacob, who's known nothing but curse ever since he stole the blessing, is he understands this now. And in his movements, he expresses the reality of this. In 32:18, when he gives instructions to his own servants, he says, tell Esau, they belong to your servant. And in verse 20, it says, be sure to say, your servant Jacob is coming behind us. So Jacob is now taking on the servant role, knowing that stealing a blessing that makes him lord over his brother is worth nothing. Are you with me on that point? There's the reality of servanthood. God has promised it to Jacob, but stealing it is not the way to get there. And Jacob is now, in a sense, letting go of that which he has stolen. If it's ever going to happen, if it's ever going to work in his favor, it's going to be because God has blessed him, not because he's stolen this blessing. So he's now giving these gifts, and he's saying, describe me as the servant. And verse 20 then gives some of the motivation for it. Verse 20 says, be sure to say, your servant Jacob is coming behind us. There again, it's Jacob at the tail end of the parade. For he thought, I will pacify him with these gifts. Now, I don't know what translation you're using. This is the NIV 84. I will pacify him with these gifts. The language there is a language of propitiation. It's what you do to appease, well, a God who's angry with you. It's the atonement language, which we find in the Day of Atonement, the mercy seat, the Ark of the Covenant, all those sort of things. Jacob is saying, I will atone his face, literally. I will pacify, I will propitiate his face with these gifts. So it's a heavily theological statement. Perhaps he will receive me. So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp. Jesus says, when you have a problem with your brother and it comes to mind as you're going to offer your sacrifice, first make peace with your brother. And I wonder if there's something of that going on here. Jacob is obligated to make peace with his brother, and he thinks he's going to do it this way. Or is that too positive a reading of it? Is he actually just offering a bribe in the way I think he tried to manipulate God just a bit with his prayer? But at least he's praying. Now he's going to bribe his brother, but at least he's doing something positive toward his brother. It's a minimal positive move, if it's positive at all. Well, so up to this point, we're seeing Jacob, and there's a bit of a pun. It's Jacob at the Jabbok, and there's a ford there of the Jabbok. I'm in verse 22, and now night has fallen, and Jacob gets up, and he takes his two wives, his two maidservants, and 11 sons, and crosses the ford of the Jabbok, and after he sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions, so Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him. In other words, everything crosses the river except Jacob. He stays behind. He is now alone. So he left alone. And what happened then? Well, he met God as he ran at Bethel. If you think back to that point where God had blessed him. And now again, 20 years later, he's back at the border of the land and he is once again alone. And he's now sent all these things over. And we just read that a man wrestled with him. And when he couldn't overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. But Jacob replied, listen to this, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob, I think, knows that this is more than just your common camping ground wrestling match, whatever that means. I've never had that experience at a campsite. So he's wrestling, but he's recognizing that there's something more going on here. And so what's he doing? Once again, in fear, he is demanding blessing. All his life, he's been trying to supplant his brother. From birth, he's described as trying to supplant his brother. He sort of succeeded in stealing the blessing. Now again, he is he's wrestling for a blessing. And the man, rather than blessing him straight away, says, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Remember the last time somebody had said, what is your name? It was when his father had asked him, what is his name? And his reply was, I am Esau, your oldest son. And now, when somebody says, what is your name? Jacob, he answered. Jacob, the deceiver. Jacob the supplanter, Jacob the fraud. This is a confession as much as it is a name. He's confessing who he is. And the man said, not anymore. Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome. You have all your life been wrestling with humanity, which is your family, and you've destroyed them. If you go back to that stolen blessing story, everybody ends up under a curse in that story. Even his mother says, let the curse fall on me. Just do as I say. So they're all under a curse at that point. That's the influence he's got in his own home. He's destroyed them. And then he goes to, well, to Laban's situation and destroys that family, you could argue. And he's got four wives. And so nothing good seems to be happening in those relationships. He's just a difficult person who makes a mess wherever he goes, but now he's confessing who he is, and it's in the presence of God. And verse 20, the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you struggle with God, and we've seen that throughout, and you struggle with men and have overcome. And for me, that's one of the more challenging parts of this. How has Jacob overcome? Well, okay, he got the best of Laban, you might say. Did he get the best of Esau? That's not clear yet. Did he get the best of God? And what does it even mean to get the best of God? Well, he's wrestling with God. And I think the overcoming language is, all your life you've been fighting for blessing. And you will be blessed. You will be blessed. It will not be because of you. It will not be because of the way you fight your battles. It will be because God, even before you were born, said you will be blessed, and you will be. This is another statement of promise. We could call it a gospel truth, that you will be blessed. And so, well, that's a pretty positive statement to receive when you're going into battle the next day. Jacob said, please tell me your name. Okay, I've told you mine. What's your name? And the figure, the person that Jacob wrestles with says, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. Isn't that great? Then he blessed him there. But he doesn't tell him his name. He says, why do you ask my name? And we could read that a number of ways. And I wonder if it's something like this. The person Jacob wrestles with is saying, don't you know who's been blessing you all along? You have to ask who's been doing so much good in your life, who's given you these herds, given you these children, given you this abundant family. You have to ask who's been doing all that. It's the God who met with you at Bethel when you left the land, and the God who is meeting with you again as you return to the land, the one who delights in pouring out his goodness upon you despite who you are. And Jacob calls the place Peniel, saying, it's because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. And of course, all through the scriptures, seeing God face to face, seeing God is described as a terrifying experience. So many times people who see something of God's say, we'll be undone, we'll die because of that experience. Jacob is saying, I saw God face to face, and I wasn't killed in that act. So I wonder if the reality is, if you can handle seeing God face to face, you'll be okay when you see your brother face to face. All right, there's more to say about that strange event, but I'm going to move on just now to verse 31. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. So as I see it, Jacob had this brilliant plan, this brilliant strategy. He's sort of up on a ridge. There's the river, and there's that place where he sent his herds and his flocks. And first he's going to send those things which are, let's say, of less value to him, I guess the goats, the sheep, that sort of thing. And, well, Esau, when he comes along, if he slaughters them, well, Esau can still run. And then he'll send, let's say, his least favored wives and their children. And so he can send them ahead. And if Esau slaughters them, Jacob can turn and run. And if he receives those things, well, good. And then the next wife and some more children get there, and Jacob can turn and run if Esau slaughters them. Do you see what I'm getting at? Now, Jacob has a perspective on this where he can see what's happening and he can run away. At the last second, even, Jacob can still run away because he's on the other side of this river, this ravine. He can run away. And, well, we know he's a runner. He left the land running. He ran from Esau, that is. He ran from Laban to get back to the land. Well, he can just run away again. Except, did you notice what happened? He can no longer run away. The one option that he preserved for himself, God took away when he met with him. He said, you will return to the land. And so God actively removes the option of him running away as he, let's say, dislocates or damages his hip. So now Jacob is an invalid who cannot run away. This is a God whose purposes will be realized, and a God who eliminates options in his gracious, loving care of his children. Verse 31 draws us in that direction. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. God has made him the runner to no longer be a runner. I also want to just note the language of the sun rose. Only because I think it's a really nice touch. When God met with Jacob at Bethel, he made promises to him. He revealed himself in certain ways in a dream. And it ends by saying, and the next day, basically, the sun, I've got that wrong. It starts by saying the sun set at Bethel. And that's when God meets with him. So the sun set at Bethel. And it's 20 years later, and the text never says anything about the sun. The sun hasn't risen until he's now back in the land, and it says the sun rose. So you've got the sun setting and 20 years of living in darkness, and now the sun rising. So the dark clouds are gathering when we read about Esau, but there's a light shining through at the same time when we read about this sun rising above him. Nevertheless, he's limping. So how's this going to go? Verse 1 of chapter 33 says, Jacob looked, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. And so he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. So he's still filled with terror, but he's a changed person. Watch what he does. Verse 2 says, he put the maidservants and their children in front. That is to say, let's say the most disposable wives at the front of the parade. And then he puts Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph, the beloved ones, in the rear. And so all these people are sort of set out as a parade so Jacob can respond to it. But now something is profoundly different. Verse 3 says, he himself went on ahead. Remember what he told his servants? Twice he told them, Jacob is coming behind us. That's the message you relay to Esau. Jacob is coming behind us. But Jacob didn't come behind us. Now that the day has dawned, Jacob himself went on ahead. He's not the last in the line. He's now the first in the line. There's a problem that needs to be confronted, and Jacob is no longer going to run from it because he can't. He's going to go and meet Esau first in this long line. How significant is that? Verse 3 says, he went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. In verse 5, he speaks of the servant. Verse 6, it says he bowed down. Verse 7, twice, there's bowing down. Verse 8, the language of my Lord. Over and over and over, that language of servant and Lord comes through. And I've tried to give shape to that just a bit in the notes that I've written. Verse 4, love this one. But Esau ran to meet Jacob. Esau does what Jacob cannot do. He ran to meet him. And tell me if this sets off any bells, any reminiscences as you hear these verbs. Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him and threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Is that not exactly the language of the prodigal son? It's what the father does when the prodigal returns. He runs and he embraces his son and throws his arms around him, and he weeps as he holds his son close to him. That's what Esau does. Now, I think that's challenging in a number of ways. First of all, well, who is this Esau? What does motivate him? How can he be so forgiving, so accepting of his brother? That's the response you get. But another question I have is, how do you think the Jews, when they hear the story of the prodigal son, would have felt hearing things in those terms, where Jacob, that is Israel, doesn't come off as well as Esau, that is Edom, in this story? So one of the great enemies of Israel is being presented this way. The father is enacting the activity of this enemy of Israel. It's sort of blending, it's sort of mixing categories in a way that I think would be really confronting in the way Jesus tells that. I'm going to move on, but maybe there's something that we should contemplate in that. So Esau looks up and he sees the women and children. Who are these with you? You've been gone so long. What's this crowd? And Jacob's answer is, they are the children God has graciously given your servant. So there again, the servant language. And the maid servants and children approach and they bow down. And Leah and her children come and bow down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they bow down. So the promise had been, going way back to what Isaac has said, you'll be lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. But that's not happening here. In fact, the opposite is happening. They're all bowing down to Esau. So in that sense, it's all been stood on its head. Esau asked, what do you mean by all these droves I met? And Jacob replies, to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, he said. Now, what I'm trying to suggest here is that the stolen blessing meant nothing, and God's blessing meant everything. and Jacob is starting to figure that out. And I think, again, Moses is trying to communicate this to us in a whole bunch of ways. So verse 9 contributes to that. Esau says, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Presumably he's been successful on his own. God had promised him he would, just not as successful as Jacob. And so he says, I already have plenty. And the word that he uses is the word that's translated older or elder in other places. For example, when it says the older will serve the younger, that's the same word in Hebrew. And so when he says, I already have plenty, it's sort of a reminder that he is the older one. And Jacob's reply then is significant. No, please, said Jacob, if I have found favor in your eyes, literally, take my blessing. Take this gift or accept this gift from me could be better rendered, take my blessing. So what Jacob is doing, I think, is in all sorts of ways handing back that which he had stolen. The stolen one talked about who will bow down, who will be Lord, and the stolen one had other things attached to it, and Jacob is saying, take this blessing. Because obviously he doesn't need it. Because the only blessing that's going to make any difference is the one that God has given. Not the one he fights for, not the one that he tries to extract by his own strength, but the one that God has offered him. And Esau surely doesn't know what to make of this. But here they are as brothers being reconciled. Jacob doesn't just say, take my blessing. He adds this, for to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Before he was going to propitiate the face of Jacob, then he saw God face to face. That's what Peniel was all about. And now he says, to see your face is like seeing the face of God. This is from a man who knows what it is to see the face of God. And he says, to see you, to have this reconciliation. There's something holy. There's something divine about reconciliation. And it's not all vertical. There's a horizontal dimension to it as well that God calls us to. And Jacob is realizing the value of this. It's like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably. Verse 11, please accept the present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me. Again, naming the giver of good things, and I have all I need. And because Jacob was persistent in trying to give this gift, Esau finally accepts it. Jacob says, I have all I need. When will you arrive at the situation when you can say, I have all I need? We're sort of wired differently, aren't we? We're wired so that there's always something more that we want. There's something more that we think we need. Have we arrived at the point where we can say, I have all I need? What does Jacob have? Well, what were the things promised in the blessing? Wives and children, a certain amount of abundance. And these are the things that he's received. And here we see a picture of his contentment. Not that life is going to get easy now, but there's a contentment because it's what God has done for him. And so Esau accepts this and says, well, let's get going. Verse 13, just to round things off, Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender. I'm going to skip over the rest. Verse 14, so let my Lord go on ahead of his servant. So again, we see the language of servant and master, servant and Lord throughout the section. Even at the end of verse 15, just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. So Esau goes his way and Jacob goes back to Sukkoth to make booths for his animals and where he's going to live for a while. So we've got Jacob now back in the land. He's returned. He's presented as in some ways a new person, or at least a changed person, one who realizes certain important truths about who God is and God's dealings with humanity. Just before I stop, I want to observe something briefly about the wrestling incident. And there's so much more to say, and there's so many unanswered questions in that incident. But in the notes at 2.2, I tried to think about applications. And the second one is pretty straightforward, that God eliminates options. And maybe he's eliminating options in your own life. Maybe he has done that. And that's part of his grace. But for Jacob, that was a very painful experience and would have hardly seemed like grace in the moment. And yet it was God accomplishing his purposes. But the first one is different. And I think it's more tied into Moses' overarching agenda, his literary accomplishment even. So it picks up some points from the birth of Jacob and Esau. That is to say, 20 years ago, Rebekah was pregnant, and then the twins are born, and Jacob was, well, what was Jacob doing? He was wrestling, and he's holding on in a bid for pride of place, as I describe it here, a bid for seniority. Even if it's only a minute, he'll take it. He wants to be born first, and he receives a name based on the way he wrestled. Okay, that was 20 years ago. Now, 20 years later, again, the number 20 is significant here. It was after 20 years of no children for Rebecca that she became pregnant. Now, it's 20 years of struggles on Jacob's part, and Jacob is wrestling again, and he's holding on, and what's he doing? He's demanding blessing, and he receives a new name based on the way he wrestles. Do you see the parallels then between those two events? 20 years, blessing, a new name. These sort of things are all sort of piling up. And I think the parallels suggest that this is intended to imitate or to mimic Jacob's birth story. And if I'm reading this correctly, then this event can be described as, I think, a story of new birth. Now, I'm not saying that the entire New Testament unfolding of what it is to be born again is present here. You have to wait for John 3 and other passages to get the full-blown story. But at least the seeds of new birth are being sown, a story that will come to full flower in the teachings of Jesus, where he says, you must be born again. What does that look like? Well, Jacob, in some ways, is being presented as a man who is being born again, as he has an encounter with God, and well, he becomes new in so many ways that you have to give him a new name. He becomes somebody he never was before, and somebody who is fit for reconciliation with God and with man as he wrestles with God and man. So I think that at least part of the wrestling story is trying to communicate that point to us, that there's a new birth that God provides, and the seeds of that new birth go way back into Genesis chapter 32. Okay, something to think about there anyway, I think. Does that mean Jacob is now good? He's been born again. He's got a relationship with God. Should we assume he becomes good? Well, that's not exactly the way the gospel works, is it? We talk about reconciliation, justification, and sanctification. And for some people, elements of sanctification are immediately obvious. And for others, well, it just takes a long time. And even in his relationship with Esau in the next few verses, I think that Jacob isn't entirely honest and dealing from a position of integrity. And yet he has had an encounter with God that's changed who he is. Okay, that's as far as I wanted to go today. So I'll stop, and maybe we have some questions, maybe we don't.
Phil, the Old Testament goes on in different places seemingly to use the term Jacob and Israel interchangeably. Do we always have to kind of think about the context here, going back to the new name and how that might, why he'd be called Israel in a certain place, or the God of Israel, or the God of Jacob?
Yeah. I tried at one time to maintain the idea that when the nation is called Jacob, that's God viewing them negatively. And when they're called Israel, that's when God is maybe a bit more optimistic. But I found that it didn't really hold up. So what I would do is ask every time if I come across the word Jacob, is it looking at him at the nation as the supplanter, the rebellious people, that sort of thing? But I've moved away from any sharp distinction between the two. Does that respond to your question? Is that what you were asking?
I think it was along that line, yeah. Mm-hmm. So do I have to stop and consider why it might be called Jacob rather than Israel?
Yeah, I think I would say not that much. It usually seems to be more for poetic reasons. It's interesting to me. Abraham, once he's named Abraham, he's never called Abram again. He's always called Abraham. But with Jacob, you get both of those names in different places. And sometimes it seems like it's just to provide structural parallels in a poetic fashion and little more than that. I think that's what it is.
So, Phil, in chapter 27, Isaac gives Esau a blessing as well. And I was wondering where he says, but when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck, being his brother's yoke from his neck. At what point do you see that happening in this story? Or do you see that taking place during this story in chapter 23 when they meet again, or 33, excuse me.
Yeah, I wouldn't see it that way. So the blessing of Jacob is basically your dwelling will be with the earth's riches, and for Esau's will be away from the earth's riches. Jacob says the dew from heaven above will be yours, for Esau's from the dew of heaven above, and so on. So it's exactly the opposite in that way. And in verse 40, it says, you'll live by the sword and you will serve your brother. The language of serving and the sword, I think, is really significant. So when you look at the language of denunciations of Edom in the Old Testament, the sword is really common in those statements. And we see that in a number of places. So when Israel is trying to return they're coming out of Egypt to get to the land, Edom opposes them, and there's a language of the sword. And then we get other kings and significant figures who are attached in some way to Edom. So, for example, Agag, you remember the story of Agag, who is a king that opposes Israel? And there's talk of the sword there. And he is an Edomite. And where that comes to even greater significance, perhaps, is in the book of Esther, where Haman, how is Haman described? He's an Agagite. He's a descendant of these Edomites. So who is trying to destroy, literally destroy the nation of Israel in captivity? It's Edom asserting its power over Israel. And it's only through God's grace because, well, they have, in a sense, thrown off the yoke. They have become ascendant, and yet God doesn't let that come to fulfillment, because he divinely rescues his people. And you might say the ultimate expression of this is in the story of Jesus' birth, because Herod is an Edomite, an Idumean king, and it's the sword of Herod that kills all those babies in Bethlehem to prevent the ascent of the rise of the new king, the King Jesus who has come. So right through the scriptures, we get references to the sword of Edom and its implications for people who are intent on what? Destroying the people of God and undoing the work of God in bringing salvation. So the sword is not sort of incidental to that. It wouldn't have worked if it was you will live by the spear, or you will live by your military might. It's the sword which is explicitly named here, and that gets carried on through the history of the Edom versus Israel interactions. I think even in Acts 12, if I remember correctly, James is put to death by another Herod with the sword. So you get that those references tying those things together. Again, I don't know. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Okay. If you're asking sort of where do we see Edom ascendant over Jacob, I think you see that sort of in the history of Israel as Edom becomes a nation earlier. The kings, already in the book of Genesis, I think it's chapter 36, you get a list of the princes of Edom. So that clan rises politically before Israel is even sort of intact as a nation. And of course, then Israel is in Egypt for all that time. So you've got hundreds of years that before Israel even has a chance to fight on a level playing field with Edom.
Okay.
Any other questions for Phil? Um,